Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. This week, it's They Might Be Giants, The Story of My Life, The Love Language, and The Idiot Box, all in one big show. They Might Be Giants have recorded 16 albums, Flood has been certified platinum, their children's music albums have all been certified gold, and Eddie Garcia shares his chat with TMBG's John Linnell. Then, three local award-winning documentarians and the Sawtooth School for Visual Art are teaming up for a multimedia experience that will make your heart sing. Before you burst into song, though, you definitely want to hear some Love Language. Eddie Garcia returns with Stuart McLam of The Love Language, up close and personal. He's got a new album out and heading to Sika. And we go out with a laugh at the Idiot Box Comedy Club in Greensboro. Comedians Eric Trundy and Jenny Stenzel will get their minutes next after this news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and you know, my name may be David, but I'm about to kick back and relax while technical producer Eddie Garcia takes on the Giants.
Don't let start. This is the worst part. To believe for all the world that you're my precious little...
They Might Be Giants have been making off-kilter alternative rock since before that particular term had ever been coined. Friends and musical partners John Linnell and John Flansburgh began as a duo in Brooklyn, New York, back in 1982. They were staples in the Lower East Side club scene, and by 1986 they released their first record featuring the song Don't Let Start, which we're listening to right now.
The words I'm singing now mean nothing more than me out to an animal.
The two Johns signed with Elektra Records in 1989 and released the platinum-selling record Flood, which boasted alt-rock hits Birdhouse in Your Soul and Istanbul, Not Constantinople, a song that was all over MTV, particularly in the wee hours, back when MTV actually showed videos. The band continued to release albums throughout the 90s, such as Apollo 18 and John Henry, all the while touring relentlessly with a fleshed-out band, making visually ingenious videos and developing a cult-like fan base. The last decade saw They Might Be Giants winning a Grammy for the theme song to the television series Malcolm in the Middle. They also dove headfirst into the world of kids' music, which is not that surprising given their flair for fun, engaging, and spirited pop music that has been known to serve up unexpected lessons on history, geography, and science. They've also had a documentary made about them. Gigantic, A Tale of Two Johns, was released in 2003 and featured live performances and interviews with the likes of Jon Stewart, Frank Black of the Pixies, and Ira Glass. With a platinum record, three gold records, two Grammys, an iPhone app, and 15 full-length albums, not to mention tons of EPs and singles under their belts, they've just released their 16th album, Nanobots.
Grow the nanobots. Loads of nanobots. Throw them in the cracks.
They Might Be Giants are hitting the road, and they'll be taking the stage at Ziggy's in Winston-Salem on Sunday, October 13th. I had a chance to talk with John Linnell from his home in Brooklyn, days before he and the rest of the Giants headed out on tour. 25 songs in just under 45 minutes. What is it about short songs, you know, that appeals to you guys?
I think that John and I came up in the punk rock period, and we feel like the promise of the incredibly short song has never been properly fulfilled, you know. Mm-hmm. I think there's something very exciting and thrilling and satisfying about that format, you know, the extremely short song where you essentially just say exactly what you have to say and get the hell out. The other thing is it's a fun kind of song to write because you have your idea and there's really not a lot of revision or fiddling around. It's like a prose poem. You just come up with the idea, and if it's no good, you have to just move on and try writing another one from scratch because they don't tend to be subject to a lot of revision. So that's one of the very fun and satisfying things about writing them, and I think they're fun to listen to.
Let's go backwards and destroy the past. How long will your oxygen last?
Some of the songs on the record, you've got, you know, a 6-second song like Hive Mind, and some 15, yep. 17 seconds. Do you feel like they're standalones, or do you, it seems like some of them are almost in together, like in a suite, or are they really working within the whole context of the record?
Well, the notion was we've done the suite thing in the past, mm-hmm. you know, with a track called Fingertips on our fourth album, Apollo 18, you know, back then was when we established this way of doing very short ideas in a way that we liked. And in the intervening time, we've occasionally done short songs or short suites of songs. But the notion on this album, on Nanobots, is that these are individual songs that can be listened to individually in any order. They should stand by themselves. That's how they're conceived. They don't actually belong together.
Everywhere around this bird, they're running out of verbs, adverbs and adjectives. Everywhere around this town, they're running out of nouns, they're running out of nouns.
Well, along with those songs, I mean, there's definitely plenty of pop songs, 2.5 minute, 3 minute songs.
Yeah.
A few like Replicants, Nanobots, and Block Ops, which I know is a Flansburgh tune. They have that They Might Be Giants playfully sinister feel, but there's this vaguely political thing on some of those songs. I mean, was that a conscious?
I would say to various degrees, the politics of Black Ops are pretty overt, I would say, which is it's about those people who conduct clandestine wars. Apparently, is how we mostly conduct wars nowadays. You know, it's troubling. But, I mean, I would say, like, that in any case, whenever we write a song that seems to have a political message, that the point of the song is to be a song. It's delivering what a song delivers, which is, a story that you listen to, that you respond to. You know, it's not a manifesto or a tract or anything like that. That's not what we do.
Hi, I forgot your name. Whatever. My point is, hi, your head's on fire. Oh, damn.
You're on fire, which is the album kicks off with. Upbeat song and lots of really cool guitar parts on there. And you guys made a great video to go along with that.
You know, we hire people who are often these kind of amazingly brilliant visual artists to do the videos, and I would say, like, most of the time they just come up with all this stuff on their own. It's very gratifying for us to have somebody else do something creative with our work that is so open-ended and spontaneous. I would say isn't just the obvious thing you would make based on the music.
Mm-hmm. That's always been the case with your videos, it seems. I mean, I was, you know, when I was younger and staying up really late watching 120 minutes and your videos came on, it seemed like you always do affiliate yourself with people who could really do something really interesting.
We really didn't want the video to just be a visual enactment of the lyrics. And I think we felt pretty strongly that that just seemed too dead of an idea. I think it was partly our fear of it seeming thoughtless that we really insisted that the visuals not be what we call see-say. In other words, that they're not just direct acting out of the lyrics in the song.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, now Constantinople, so if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say. People just liked it better that way. So take me back.
You and Flansburgh write most of the songs independently, or do you write together, or is it a mix?
We almost entirely write independently, you know. We each write songs. Of course, you know, when we're writing, we're always thinking of the other guy's inevitable auditioning of it. And, you know, I think for me, and I think probably this is true for John as well, there's nothing more crushing than writing something, you know, having it met with less than enthusiasm, you know. I'm very concerned that John isn't left cold by the song, so I'm thinking about him when I'm writing it. You know, it's got to be good, particularly because this other guy is going to say what he has to say about it. You know, and I think he probably feels the same way, that, you know, it's a drag if I'm like, well, that's okay.
Yeah. You have so many songs that have complex or deceptively simple, in some cases, arrangements. Do you get that all fleshed out before you head into the studio, or do you kind of leave a little bit to be opened
up
in the studio?
Well, this is the way it works now, is we almost always have an idea for the rhythm section, and we try and spell those things out. But I think that we also feel like it could get changed. We could certainly change it up And we have these musicians who are really great at coming up with spontaneous ideas. It's just a question of how strongly we feel about what we've come up with already. And then there's a certain amount of editing that goes on. You know, we'll often over-track a song, and then the way we wind up mixing it is by stripping out stuff and, you know, trying to make it simpler by removing tracks until we like what's left.
Does that help for live translation, too?
Well, the live is a whole other problem because we don't necessarily mimic the album arrangement in the live version. So we have to come up with something that works live, that obviously that the five of us can play and that brings something to the song, you know. It doesn't have to sound exactly like the record.
All right. Well, when you come to Winston, what's in store for the show? Is it all nanobots all the time? Is it, you know, a mix of classics? And what are you doing?
Yes. It's a mix of the music of the 80s, 90s, O's. I still don't know what you call that decade.
People try to say aughts, and that just seems, I don't like that.
Yeah. We'll be playing a mix of all those decades, the aforementioned decades. We will be focusing on our new album, Nanobots. We've got about 7 or 8 songs that we play from the new album. And then we will also play a mix of stuff that was made into videos, in other words, the singles, and stuff that is more obscure, like album tracks, stuff that the people in the front row want to hear.
A shooting star is not a star.
Let's talk about your contribution to the world of kids' music. You spent a big chunk of the last decade, the unnamable Zero Zeros, working on kids' music. How did you get into that?
We were not taking it very seriously as an idea originally. We were given a small amount of money by Rounder to make a kids' record, which, you know, seemed like just like a fun project. It wasn't really like a career move, certainly. And it kind of exploded. The kids' record that we made, which is called No, outsold Mink Car, probably like sold half again as many copies. So I think we sort of sat up at that point and thought, oh yeah, this is the thing we could do. This is a whole audience. It didn't seem like a ghetto. I think we were concerned when we first started out that people, you know, our first album looks like a kid's record because it's got this kind of almost like H.A. Ray, Curious George style of art on it. And in fact, Tower Records, when they received it, accidentally slotted it into their children's record department. We had to let them know that it was not a kid's record. But over time we learned that parents did like to play our music for their kids. And I think when we made No, we were sort of thinking we'd make a record that was basically a They Might Be Giants album, only that was appropriate for kids. It wasn't supposed to be dumbed down, or we didn't smooth off the edges completely.
What do you think kids appreciate?
Well, I think we found out that kids need entertainment just as much as adults. And even though often the expectation is that music for kids is supposed to be good for them somehow, we thought, well, that's not the way people treat culture for adults. So why should we make it any different for kids? I think kids need to be entertained, you know, as much as adults. So that was the philosophy. That made it also interesting for us, you know, that it didn't seem like just like a chore.
Yeah.
You know.
So you've released an app for iPhone and Android in conjunction with the new record. Could you tell listeners about that?
Well, it's kind of an extension of the Dial-A-Song thing that we started doing in the 80s.
Could you explain Dial-A-Song for...
Okay. Dial-A-Song was a phone machine in Brooklyn that you'd call up and listen to our songs. And that's all it was. It was a very simple idea. We started advertising in the Village Voice in New York, you know, with just a phone number. You just call up, listen to a song. And it kept going for, I guess, pretty far into the 90s before it kind of became impossible to maintain. But by that time, there started to emerge other ways of getting your music out that were not through records or radio. So, you know, it started to seem like, in a sense, that internet stuff had kind of replaced Dial-A-Song for us. You know, the bizarre and ironic thing is that Dial-A-Song was unique, as far as I know. Now, everybody listens to music on their phone. That's just ordinary. And if people buy music without going out of the house and all that stuff, in some ways, that was the whole point of dial sawing in the first place. So I think, in a sense, we now live in this environment where everything is like dial sawing. And so, we're just continuing to exploit that reality now.
Right.
Yeah.
You can hear in the alley by the light switch. Who watches over you? Make a little birdhouse in your soul. Not to put too fine a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul.
You know, you guys have been playing together over 30 years. I mean, not many musical collaborations last that long.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's easier for me to speculate about why bands break up. We can't compare our experience because we didn't break up. You know, my sense is that the reason that bands break up is often pretty simple and predictable, which is that they start out doing something they're very excited about, and then they're disappointed in some way, where they feel like they're missing out on something else, or they're frustrated with the limitations of their collaboration. And now for us, those things didn't happen. We never felt like we were being held back or that the potential seemed to be unfulfilled. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Instead, I think we kind of felt like, well, if there is unfulfilled potential, like, we can just like continue to work until we fulfill it. But it seems like we're still impressed by the amount of potential, I guess. And it's fun and satisfying doing this. So I don't know what it would be like for the Mighty Giants to break up, because we never did. So
yeah.
I don't know why we should, you know. I don't know what would be the reason for it to happen, you know.
To make a huge comeback, of course.
Well, that would be the cynical thing to do. Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, it's been great talking with you.
Nice speaking with you. We're looking forward to coming down to Winston-Salem once again. It'll be a really fun show.
Awesome.
Killing Jason off and countless screaming.
John Linnell of They Might Be Giants. Their 16th album, Nanobots, packs 25 songs into 45 minutes, and it's available right now. You can experience They Might Be Giants live and up close at Ziggy's in Winston-Salem, Sunday, October 13th. You'll find links to tickets, music, and their app at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Triad Arts Weekend technical producer Eddie Garcia. Eddie will be back on the second half of the show with more new music that you're going to want to check out. It's The Love Language, up close and personal. And comedians Eric Trundy and Jenny Stenzel are here from the Idiot Box Comedy Club to you with love on Triad Arts Weekend after this short break. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got music by The Love Language and hilarious comedy by two stand-ups who love what they do coming up in just a bit. But first, The Story of My Life shares the lives of six adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Greg Silvernail, James Loudermilk, John Linville, Cecilia Henry, Karen Lash, and Jeri Lockard. Their stories are told through photographs, spoken and written word, and visual art that they created in collaboration with instructors from the Sawtooth School for Visual Art. The multimedia exhibition at the Eleanor and Egbert Davis Gallery in Sawtooth opens Friday, October 11th at 5:30 with a nice reception. It'll remain on display through November 14th at the Sawtooth School in Winston-Salem. The Story of My Life is told by three local award-winning documentarians, photographer Christine Rucker, journalist and multimedia editor Michelle Johnson, and investigative journalist, narrative writer, and college teacher Phoebe Zerwick. Christine and Phoebe were joined in the studio by Sawtooth Executive Director Joanne Vernon. The whole notion of art really surpassing the spoken word in terms of your ability
Absolutely.
To get to know an individual interested me. And you were there firsthand. What did you gather from that?
Of the six adults that we actually had experiences with, probably over half of them have some difficulty with speech. And so really the thing that's remarkable about visual arts in particular, and I'm sure people would say about music and photography as well, is that it doesn't necessarily require that you are able to enunciate, but that you can lose yourself in the moment. You can be totally present in what you're doing, and that it moves you to a different level of consciousness. You're just in that particular moment. And these are people who have very active lives. They're engaged in a lot of other activities in their lives, but I don't know that they're doing regular artistic, hands-on. I mean, I know they do things with music, but in terms of making objects. So this was really sort of an out-of-norm experience for them, and I think it allowed them to just at least experience life in a different way.
For those yet to see this, it's a real all-engaging adventure, and you really feel like you get a sense of each individual, talking about Karen, James, John, Cecilia, Greg, and Dree. I mean, I'm seeing some wonderful photos there, but are there some, or maybe one or two, that for you, you're particularly proud of in the way you captured either a moment or a personality, if you can think of it in those terms, Christine?
We'll kind of start with Greg. And Greg had so many different incredible images because he was very engaging and you just kind of fell right under his spell. You know, I went back to the first image that I took of Greg, which was he's sitting in front of birthday cake on his birthday, surrounded by his caretaker and housemates and his family. And apparently, you know, his birthday was one of the most important holidays of the entire year. But just the light on his face and the light in the candles, I just think that really captured Greg. John Linville, I had to really spend a little bit more time with John because he was nonverbal. And it was a challenge to me because I wanted to tell each person's story uniquely, honestly. I really wanted to capture who they were. And then I spent some time with his sister and his twin brother. And I think the one image that speaks the most to me of John is when he's at dinner at his sister's house and they all are surrounded around a table holding hands and saying the dinner prayer. I just felt like that was the image to me that spoke the most about John Linville.
For a photographer to do great work in portraiture, or even to some degree candids, I would think there's so much spoken about developing that rapport between you and the person on the other side of the lens. Was that something coming at this, dealing with people who are, or in the case of John, obviously nonverbal, others with varying degrees of disability? How did that impact that ability, and what did you learn through the process?
That was tough for sure. I mean, you have to connect with your subjects on some level, and you have to be patient. You know, that connection sometimes happens right away, like it did with Greg. It happened right away. And with Karen Lash, it happened right away. But with, you know, John Linville, I had so many extra visits to the group home and just spending time with him. I went to his where he works and spent time with him. And then finally, I just really saw what his family members saw. And I think that one image is when I felt like I had a connection.
Joanne, in terms of this whole project, and I guess we'll focus in on the artistic component at Sawtooth and seeing people paired with instructors and creating this art, what do you walk away with?
I think, first of all, that the hope that we get to do something like this again, because you never want this to be a one of when you come out of an experience where it's really compelling and very emotional and touching. One of the images that I have locked in my head is that the instructors were taking the photographs during the classes, and there's a great photo of John standing with this incredible grin on his face over this piece that he has made. It has the crushed cans on it. It has these little silhouettes of birdhouses. Of course, he loves his birds and his birdhouses. And then also a photograph of Nanette Davis, who was teaching Greg. And Greg is such a dear, sweet, just cheery personality. And they're leaning into one another. And he has made this wonderful construct with all the electronic pieces, but it is an aerial view looking down on New York City. And so what you get to see is his two passions colliding into this one wonderful piece, and then also just the sheer joy on their face. And so you have that experience and you think, this crystallizes for me why I do what I do with Sawtooth, because these experiences really are, they are life-changing for so many people.
Phoebe, I'm wondering, when I was reading the synopses or the essays that went with each individual, how much back and forth was there between you and the people directly that you're working with, either Karen, James, John, Cecilia, Greg, or Jerry? And then I appreciated reading them, and I would think in my case there'd be a real temptation to lapse into some poetic prose, but it's you tell their stories in a even more powerful way by telling it in your really nice direct style.
Sure. So I'm going to back up for a second. Christine and I have worked together on and off for probably 15, 20 years. And when we first started working together, we were at the newspaper. And all of our projects were driven by the story, by the reporting, by the writing, and then the photography came in, not after the fact, it was intrinsic to it, but it came second. And this story was driven, I would say, by the photography. A number of the people we worked with were difficult to connect with, especially for me because of the language difficulty. And so I would watch Christine and tag along with Christine and watch her photograph. And that was sort of my guide through this, that it wasn't a connection always about language and interviewing, which is what I do. It began with more of an emotional connection, which I think is at the core of what a portrait photographer does. And I suppose we keep coming back to John Linville's story, because when we turned all of our material over to Michelle Johnson, who can make poetry out of audio, again, she also had this challenge. How was she going to capture the voice of a man who doesn't speak very much, or who barely speaks? And he's got this kind of machine that's programmed with buttons, and he can hit various buttons to say, and the machine says words. It says the words of things that he's interested in. And she was able to use it, not in an artificial way, but she was able to use it to bring out his personality and who he was, because she would use some of those buttons like, I like Texas Pete. And then she would use the recording of him laughing, and that's him, the laughter. It doesn't really matter that he can't speak a recognizable language so well, because what he speaks is from his heart.
Sawtooth School for Visual Art Executive Director Joanne Vernon, photographer Christine Rucker, and investigative journalist, narrative writer, and college teacher Phoebe Zerwick. Together with journalist and multimedia editor Michelle Johnson, they share the story of my life. The opening reception is Friday night, October 11th from 5:30 to 7:30 at Sawtooth School for Visual Art in Winston-Salem. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we come back from this short intermission, we'll jump from the love language to the idiot box quicker than a sandhill crane on a June bug. Eddie Garcia gives us a Sika concert preview, and comedians Eric Trundy and Jenny Stenzel will keep us in stitches and give us a peek behind the curtain at the comics life next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's been a busy week for technical producer Eddie Garcia. At the top of today's show, we heard his conversation with They Might Be Giants frontman John Linnell, and earlier this week, Eddie also got an insider's look at the love language and a conversation with Stuart McLam.
North Carolina has its fair share of indie rock success stories, and one of the latest musicians to make people stand up and take notice of our state's thriving music scene is Stuart McLam, the creative force behind The Love Language. What started out in a Winston-Salem apartment as a lo-fi love letter has developed into a panoramic indie pop pastiche, bringing elements of music's past, present, and future together. A wall-of-sound approach that harkens back to the days of Phil Spector and his recordings with the Crystals and the Ronettes. But beyond the strings, the horns, the glockenspiel, and the healthy dose of reverb, there's the songs. And singer, songwriter, guitarist Stuart McLam has a way with words and melodies that proves the word pop doesn't have to be a dirty word. The latest release by The Love Language is called Ruby Red. It's their third record and second to be released on Merge Records, the home of classic indie rock bands like Superchunk, Polvo, and the Magnetic Fields, and contemporary trendsetters like Spoon, She and Him, and the Grammy-winning Arcade Fire. To say McLam is in good company would be an understatement. You can see The Love Language live at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Arts, SECA, in Winston-Salem, as part of their Crossroads concert series on Thursday, October 17th. Along with the show, you'll find food, beverages, outdoor activities, and an opening set from like-minded Winston-Salem band, Estrangers. Check WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for more info.
I talked with Stu last week by phone about Ruby Red, his days in Winston-Salem, and the evolution of the Love Language sound. New record, your third album, your second for Merge Records. Ruby Red is out. Congratulations on that.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, I really, really enjoy the record. It's a little bit of a departure from some of your early stuff stylistically. I mean, but you know it's a Love Language song. You hear those, you know, reverb-drenched melodies. You know it's you.
Yeah.
But, you know, A little
reverb junkie
you are.
Yeah, working on it. I know it's an issue.
Has it always been that way? Like, have you always just had an affinity for it?
I don't know. The reverb thing started with that first record. First time I was recording stuff, so I guess it was more of a math. Like, okay, I don't know how to mic stuff. Put some reverb on it, and you get that big sound. But it's definitely a part of this record. But we were using the real deal this time, so that was nice. Some plates and all that.
Okay. Where did you record the new record?
So we did it, actually, at Ruby Red. And it was mixed at Overdub Lane in Durham. Like, a good portion of it was mixed there. The actual recordings went down at Ruby Red, which is like a artistic sort of cooperative workshop in downtown Raleigh. A good buddy of mine, Tim Lemuel, rented the building. It was just like a sort of abandoned warehouse, you know, how that goes. Just kind of slowly started getting some artists, you know, visual artists and musicians and filmmakers, all kinds of artists in there, and slowly started turning into something really cool. Very similar, I guess, to like the warehouse, but I'd say we're a good 10 years behind with you guys there. So we just pretty much made like a makeshift studio to record in. You know, I was so happy with how it turned out. A big part of that was DJ Burton, who been my buddy for years, and he toured with the band for a while and recorded and engineered Libraries, our last record before this one as well.
So the atmosphere was a little different on Libraries too. You were in a studio where this was a new record. It's kind of like you made a studio happen in a really cool space you were working in. Mm-hmm. Now, on Libraries, did you, or maybe you and BJ, play most of the instruments on the record?
Yeah, like we had some people come in. Like my brother Jordan played drums on maybe a little less than half of the record on Libraries. It was mostly the two of us in there, but it wasn't like all the way like that.
You brought a lot more musicians into this record. And I'm thinking like a song from the new record, like High Life, has so many strings and maybe glockenspiel?
I don't know.
Yeah. And these horns. And I mean, how do all those arrangements get sorted out?
Well, that song in particular, when I remember I did the demo, that one was done in Black Mountain. I went out there for about 2 months in the summer of 2011 and sorted out a lot of the writing for the record. And we were like in this kind of, it was a cabin, but it wasn't like some remote cabin. It was like sort of in a residential area.
Did you grow a big beard while you were out there?
That demo, I think I just busted out like a standard like Casio that's got like the multi-tone banks, you know? Mm-hmm. You got like strings, horns, and everything. And I think I just kept layering with that until it had sort of a big sound just for the demo. I just kind of went back through and remembered what had worked. Parts on this record are like really crazy for that. I mean, you know, when you're bringing in a string or horn player, they're classically trained and knowledgeable, so these are pretty easy to figure out. And then, you know, the strings are like one of my favorite parts of the whole record, and that was Rachel Rollins, Mark Paulson, really good friends of mine, live in Raleigh. It's sort of adorable. They're like a couple as well. Mm. They both play violin, but they added a lot to the arranging. They definitely helped me arrange certain parts.
I'm thinking about the song On Our Heels.
Mm-hmm.
Has that really simple but such a sweet, you know, little string line. Do they have something to do with that part too?
I think we did like kind of write that on the spot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely collaborative too. I think they helped me tweak like the end of the phrase or something.
Yeah, it really adds, you know, really a nice legs or something, especially with the song having like that kind of a laid back disco feel, like having those kind of strings.
Yeah,
kind of
that was
bop on top.
Like, going for some kind of Cure kind of vibe or something.
Yeah. You know, With this record, you're definitely trying out some different things.
You know, it's funny. I mean, there's parts of me that you listen like the first record, and then you listen to this one, and it's like two different bands almost. You know, with Love Language never being like a constant live band, or I feel like it's a project that I'm gonna kind of like, as long as it feels sincere and like it's with me, I'm gonna try to take it along with me and my, like, you know, not trying to sound cheesy, like my life journey or whatever. You know, let that follow me to where I'm at, as long as it feels like it's relevant, you know, tool for me to express myself. So that was one thing. I just felt like Love Language to start it out as like this sort of, you know, from this place of like lovelorn breakup songs, whatever you want to call it. That was something that would be really difficult to like perpetuate and like identify myself with. So I just chose, like, I thought this record would be a good one to just totally break that mold and to open it up to some new themes and some new styles, where like basically trying to like set the groundwork where I can kind of like take it wherever I would need to go. Like, you know, like I can try to do an 80s record or try to do something heavier or go back to doing like a lo-fi garage record next, like whatever. But just to like, for people to have no expectations about which direction you go, that frees me up to just, you know, not get stuck in a box.
It's kind of funny. I was thinking, I was like, well, the Love Language is not really a band in the traditional sense. You have a band,
yeah.
You are a band, but it's like, it's almost, it's like the rapper for you. It's like your project. I mean,
yeah,
really, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've thought a lot about this and talked about it before. Like, you see this a lot more this day and age with bands, with members coming and going and switching, and people can afford to do like their own records by themselves at home and multi-track, and the band, and then in a lot of ways all over, is sort of I don't know, it's not as tight as it used to be. I mean, there's still obviously bands, but I see that as like a lot of my friends' musical projects, as people kind of come and go, and there's not even money in music anymore, you know. And so it's always usually these short-lived things, and this is something that I wanted to really push to kind of keep going. I mean, naturally, it is my thing, but I very much need people to, like, bounce ideas and feed off them and help bring things to light. But it just seems like, naturally, you know, it's sort of a revolving door. I think from the outside, people can look at it and be like, oh, Stu's, like, this tyrannical, I don't know, loving is like this crazy dictatorship, and he's firing people left and right because the lineup changed. But that's hardly the case. It's always been like more about like, well, that was a rad tour, I got a job offer, I'm gonna do this, or like, I'm really stoked on this project, or I'm moving to this town, I'm getting married. You know, that's been a lot of why people have come and gone, is just their lives have had things that come into their lives that were more important to them than this band, which I totally understand. It's like, I'm the broke dude in the band. Other people are doing cool stuff, you know. I think people look at it the other way, as like, why wouldn't they be in the band? It's like, because you make no money doing that.
Lyrically, this record, it's also stretching out a little bit. I know I talked a lot about the music and the sonics, but lyrically, it seems like there's more of hopeful, embracing, spirited feel. How did that all kind of come?
I mean, it took a long time to get this record out. I struggled a lot with writer's block, and I think that was me just trying to like sort of figure out how to get out of it, like the whole breakup theme or what I was supposed to write about. I don't know. I guess I was like kind of in a funky place, and then I started to write. But a lot of the lyrics actually came after Black Mountain. A lot of the music was done there, and some songs were completed lyrically then. But I came back to Raleigh, and I ultimately just decided it would be good to just explore like some more universal themes, you know. I realized that this was a good opportunity for the record to get outside of myself and my ego, would bring other people in, and not writing these songs with I and me all over the place. So I've always written from like sort of a cryptic kind of place. It's really hard for me to write a song about one particular thing, but I feel like it's always like a jumble. But one, like, it's vague, but the underlying theme of the record, I think, is just this feeling that this like new sort of era is approaching pretty swiftly, you know. I feel like everybody kind of feels it. It's hard to like put your finger on what it is, but technology is making these great leaps every day. We're like trying to catch up with that, and I feel like just the overall consciousness is, we're starting to like see through some of the old ways, and
things really seem like we're just, they've been in flux for a while, but now we're starting to get on the other side of it. Maybe I think people are finding new ways to do things, new ways to form
like
their lives.
It feels like a really big change. I mean, I think, yeah, exactly. It's like this weird moment, but it's about to flip, kind of.
Yeah,
that was the theme. It's sort of like this, like, death and rebirth kind of thing going on in the record.
So I remember when you were kicking around town a couple of years back. Why don't you tell everyone about your Winston-Salem connection?
Yeah, that started with the local superstars, Auto Passion. And we met them, my old band, the Capulets. We got up with them, and this was back in the MySpace days. And I remember a buddy of mine, William Cashin, who's in Future Islands, actually, they were Art Lord and Self Portraits back then. But he mentioned, he's like, you should check out this band, Auto Passion. I think you guys would be a good fit. And we listened to it and just loved it. And we set up a show and went to Salem. They just, like, really simply became some of my best friends in the world and still are. Yeah, so then we just kept in touch and played some shows and had some girls in town. And I ended up getting in a pretty serious relationship with a particular girl. And then I moved to Winston. And yeah, I stayed there for about 6 months. And... yeah, it's funny. That's actually where those were the first Blood Language songs were written, was living there. Gray Court Apartments. That's one of the songs on the first record was Gray Court, because I was living out there. And that was pretty much it. I lived there for a while, and if you listen to the first record, you know that it didn't all end in roses, but but it was, yeah, we're still good friends and everything, but it was 6 months of that I look back on very fondly, but it was a little rough in the middle of it.
So I just got to say, I'm very curious, what has the experience been like being on Merge Records?
When it happened, like when I got the news that we were getting signed, that was just something, even though they're local, I just never imagined that would be a reality for myself. They were just a legendary label. And when that happened, I remember I laid down on my bed. I just think I stared at my ceiling. I don't even know what was going through my head, but I swear I think it was for like 3 hours. I think I was just like sitting there, just like staring blankly at the ceiling. It was really like a dream come true. It's like crazy to experience something like that, you know?
Yeah.
That's how it was for me. And, but I mean, as far as like them as a label, it couldn't be more laid back. It's just like, you know, they have such a far reach and they can do a lot for an artist. Obviously, they've been doing it for a while and they've been in the business for a while.
But, and they've had some pretty major successes over the past, you know,
yeah,
5 to 10 years,
and
too.
Yeah, they know what they're doing. But at the same time, you know, it definitely still feels like a small label. Like, they, in a lot of ways, too, you know, like they're right in my backyard. And
yeah.
I feel so fortunate, you know, to not only just to be on that label, but for them to just be right in my backyard. It's a really great thing. It doesn't feel like they're, like, too big, you know what I mean, of an operation or something. It's still very personable.
They've retained their values.
Yes, yeah, definitely. I think when they sign an artist, they really let them do their own thing. So it's funny, like sometimes I'm just like all freaking out, like, what do you think? And then they're just like, it's great, all right. You know? they're definitely not one that's like, sit down, you have to pass the like Merge test. You know, they just let their artists express themselves and get behind it. I mean, if I like tried to rap on a song or something, we might have a conversation or something.
Maybe they make that a download only.
Yeah. And I got skills, you know.
I'm sure. All right, Stu. Well, it's been great talking to you. And
yeah, you too, Eddie.
Yeah, I'm
a pleasure.
Glad you could be on the show. Stuart McLam of The Love Language. You can see the band live at Sika in Winston-Salem as part of their Crossroads concert series on Thursday, October 17th. Winston-Salem band Estrangers will be opening the show. For tickets, music links, and to see the video for the Ruby Red track Come Down, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Technical producer Eddie Garcia. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and whenever possible, we like to leave them laughing. To wrap up today's show, we're going to go straight to the gags with two of the best in the business. Did you know the art of comedy is alive and well right here in the Triad? It certainly is, and much of the credit goes to the Idiot Box Comedy Club in Greensboro. There you'll find a veritable beehive of activity going on year-round. This fall is no exception with their monthly Knuckleheads production, an all-ages, kids-friendly show with stand-up, improv, and sketches. Comedian Eric Trundy and club owner Steve Lesser are teaching stand-up classes.
And Friday night at 8 at the Idiot Box, it's round 2 of the 6th annual Ultimate Comic Challenge. Eric knows the UCC well, as does Idiot Box co-owner Jenny Stenzel. Jenny's a comedian and improv actor, well-known to triad audiences. From 2006 to 2010, she was the comedic traffic reporter on WXII-TV. Her on-air antics, like rapping the traffic report, eventually wound up on CNN, VH1, and MSNBC. I want to get your perspective on that. I mean, dealing with comedians all the time, give me the real dope. I mean, what's that like, Jenny?
Well, I mean, you can't stop laughing. It's a great job. Right. They are big babies, but every single one of them.
I thought it was funny on, it was Joan's show where she's in bed and talking to comedians, and Sarah Silverman was on, and she asked Sarah, do you have any friends that aren't comedians? And she said, no.
Yeah,
she couldn't envision hanging out with people that can't make her laugh. I thought that was kind of interesting. Is that the scene generally, or is that unusual?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you get to the higher level, comedians call regular humans civilians, you know, and so all humans. And so it's just, I heard a while back, I heard Bill Burr and Louis C.K., and they were saying how they don't hang out with civilians, really. It's they hang with themselves, and you're constantly on and getting funnier. And so these guys who are 20 years in, they're always funny. They're just always on because they have to be, or they get torn to shreds by their closest of friends. You know what I mean? Comedians are big babies, very sensitive, most sensitive people you'll probably ever meet.
Yeah, I remember last time we were going to have a big bear hug afterwards.
Yeah.
To make you feel a little bit better.
Yeah. That's what it is when you're on stage. You're asking for hugs, you know, and I say that a lot on stage. I go up and I say, hey, look, no matter what happens tonight, I'll be the guy outside, and if you see me with my head down, it's just me asking for a hug. That's all I want.
Rodney Dangerfield was right, right? I mean, comedians don't get much respect. What would you like for folks to know about what goes into it or any aspect of being a comedian?
It's a very strange thing. I think there's only a few jobs in the world. I was in an elevator in Chicago, and a bunch of people had just got off one plane and were transferring to another plane, and two guys started talking. It's like, hey, what do you do? And it made me think, there are very few jobs when you say it in a room full of strangers that piques everyone's interest. And I think comedian is one of those. There's just something about it that people are attracted to.
I looked through the CV here and I see that you're offering classes along with Jenny Sussman and co-owner of The Idiot Box, Steve Lesser.
Yep.
Comedy classes are really, in my opinion, a very silly thing. I've never believed in them. And I always thought they were a waste of money and time. Sure. But the great thing is that we have people that have come through and taken them, and they've been comedians longer than I have. And then people who have just never done it, it's on their bucket list. And so a few of the things that we try to work on is just stage presence and building good habits. And so we bring people in there, and we get them to open up as much as they feel comfortable with. And then we try to point them in the right direction. And I feel like I'm uniquely qualified to teach a class like that because I've just gone through everything that people who are new are going to go through. So I can say, these are the pitfalls you're going to run into. These are the walls. These are the stumbling blocks. And these are the good things.
What's a stage presence thing that you come across frequently that you can tweak and make a difference?
There's minutia that just goes into it. There's, you know, are there barriers between me and the audience? Are my hips facing them? Am I making eye contact? Am I stuttering? Am I looking down or am I looking up? Am I just making eye contact and engaging? Is it conversational?
When you say eye contact, and I live in the minutiae, so don't worry about that. But I mean, like, for example, in radio announcing, they say, don't pretend like you're talking to somebody. Pretend like you're talking to a specific person. Like,
yes.
Is it your best friend? Is it your Aunt Rose? Is it so that you have that engagement and you can hear it on the radio.
Yeah.
But in terms of eye contact, I always wonder, are comedians actually looking at individuals or are they just panning the room and pretending to be engaging?
It depends. I think the longer you do it and the more comfortable you get, the more eye contact you're making specifically with audience members. When I first started, I looked at the ground for the first 6 months. And then I was told, you know, you got to stop looking at the ground. So a tip I got from Steve Lesser was just look at the top of their heads. And I did that. And then what started happening is I'm looking at the top of their heads and I started creeping in these little moments of intimacy between me and one person. And that made me more comfortable because I would see them giggle or shift in some way. And now I can engage them completely. I can tell you what everybody in the crowd is wearing after 5 minutes on stage, you know. And
So, Eric, you just had the first, Eric and Jenny, first Knucklehead show. What's a Knucklehead show all about?
Knucklehead show, we're going into the third one. That's going to be in October. It's a once-a-month show. I wanted to do a show for kids, for families, and I wanted to do something very lighthearted. I'm a huge Andy Kaufman fan. And when I saw him play Radio City Music Hall and then he takes everybody in the school buses to go have cookies and milk and stuff like that, that kind of inspired me to do the Knucklehead Show. It's a stand-up comedy, it's improv, it's sketch, and we give out prizes. It's fun for all ages. It's totally clean. I wanted to do something different than I've done. And so about a year ago, I started really focusing on doing cleaner comedy and being able to engage all audiences, and this goes to that.
And your background's in improv, Jenny, is that correct?
Yeah.
It seems like that as a discipline for young kids would be invaluable in that so much of what we do in the day-to-day is just being able to respond to what's around you and kind of improvise in the best sense of the word, but it's hard for some people to do that.
Yeah. We teach improv classes, and we teach kids improv classes, and kids get it way faster than adults.
How do you teach that sort of thing?
Well, you teach the skill set you need to be able to do it. So essentially, improv is about working with other people, and nobody wants to play with the kid up the street that won't play the same games. They only want to play the game they want to play, and they only want to do what they want to do, and that doesn't work in improv. Yeah. And so it's all about taking the other person's idea and adding to it.
Or in basketball, little kids, they all want to shoot the basket, but no one wants to pass. How do you break down, how do you get into that mindset?
Improv is about the assist. So it's not about being the one that, your job is to make the other people on the stage with you, you know, make the shot. So if everybody's working together, everybody's making assists. So at the end of the show, if I made somebody else, you know, gave them an offer that made them get the biggest laugh of the night, it's a good night. It's a good night.
I used to mention
as long as I'm not the worst one.
You get it. That's right.
I'm a good guy, but I'm not that good.
Comedian, improv actor, and teacher Jenny Stensel. She's also the co-owner of the Idiot Box Comedy Club in Greensboro, and she was joined by comedian and teacher Eric Trundy. Friday night, October 11th at 8 o'clock at the Idiot Box, it's round two of the 6th annual Ultimate Comic Challenge. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You'll also find links there to their weekly stand-up performances and classes, knuckleheads comedy shows for kids and adults, improv classes, and more. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend, along with pictures and lots of helpful links, on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.